comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you happen to be around this gorgeous planet, thanks for being here at the show. I know you could be doing a million other things, but you chose to be here, and I want you to know that I appreciate that. I'm here because you matter. I'm here because you have a right to know. You know, one of the things you have a right to know about happens to be any other place where you can get lots of good information, and there's one coming up. It's Alternative Universe Eye Conference coming up in 8 days. Yep, we're that close to it, 8 days. And that means you have only 7 days, including right now, to get your ticket. 7 days to get your ticket. Then the ticket sales close to make sure that we get everybody that has purchased a ticket well informed about how to watch this conference. It's coming to you. You don't have to go to it. And you've got five great presentations coming your way. It's only $10. But there's some confusion out there. I've been getting some email, both from some members here at the Kevin Smith Show and from some non-members, people who listen to the show, but they're not members here. And confusion about, well, you know, with the members, they say, well, you know, I logged in, but, you know, I can't find any place to pay for this seminar. Well, it's not a seminar. A seminar is one person speaking to you. It's a conference. There are five people, okay? And it's not in the members community. It has absolutely nothing to do with the members community here at the Kevin Smith Show. It's open to anybody. Anybody that buys a ticket gets to watch this conference, gets to experience this conference. I get some email, I've gotten some email from people saying, well, you know, I would like to view this conference, but I don't want to join as a member. They're not related. They never have been. I've never, not one single time, ever said anything that puts them together. It's in your imagination, folks. It's in your nightmares, okay? They are not related. Of course, we would like everybody to join. We'd like everybody to be a member here because I know what you'll get when you join. I know the exciting things that you will enjoy once you join the Kevin Smith Show members community. But they are not related. This conference is on its own. It has nothing to do with the members community. Now, do you know how you get to the tickets? It's pretty easy. There's a link on my website that's about 4 feet high. You can't miss it. If you can't see that link, you're not going to be able to watch this conference anyway. I mean, it's truly gigantic. And it says Alternative Universe Eye Conference. If you click that link, it'll take you over to the page where it shows you who's speaking and what they're going to be speaking about. And there's a button for you to click to register. So you register. And then after you register, there's a page that pops open and says, thanks for registering. You have one more step left here. And the one more step is a button that you click so you can pay your $10. It's real easy, okay? Get over there and do that. All right, we're going to step away for a break. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Caleb Musgrave. And Caleb, well, we'll find out. We'll be back right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are going to be talking this evening with Caleb Musgrave. And Caleb Musgrave is a very, very interesting individual. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Caleb is Ojibwe. Now, for those of you around the world, I know our show is being listened to in about 143 countries, and you're wondering, what is an Ojibwe? Here in the United States and in Canada, we talk about how, Christopher Columbus discovered America, which, of course, is not true. Whenever these, Leif Erikson got here, Christopher Columbus got here, the Chinese got here long before either one of them, when they got here, it was populated. It was real news to the people who lived here that somebody had discovered America. It was big news. They thought they had it, And we call these Native Americans in the United States. In Canada, they are called First Nation. Generally and incorrectly, they are called Indians. I'm one sort of. I'm part Cherokee. A whole bunch of us out here are part Native American or part First Nation. He is Ojibwe. That is the name of a nation of people, a band of people, that inhabited and still do a very huge area that includes a big swath of Canada and the United States of America. Nobody clued them in. There was supposed to be a border there, you see. And so they inhabited this area. Well, he is Ojibwe. Here in the United States, the Ojibwe people are referred to as Ojibwe or Chippewa. All right? So that will give you a little bit of a clue about these folks. Now, you're going to see, in fact, you're already seeing a picture of Caleb. We're going to bring him live on video here in just a moment and talk with him. But I just want to get everybody sort of up to speed. One of the myths out there about so-called American Indians, Native Americans or First Nations people, one of the myths is that they cannot grow whiskers. And you'll see that Caleb does. But if you look at ancient pictures, old photographs of Native Americans, you'll see that some of those nations do not have whiskers, and some do. So the reason I point this out is there are a lot of myths out there about these folks who are First Nation or Native Americans. There are a lot of things people think, a lot of things people believe, and they're just not the case. One of the great, great things about the Ojibwe flies in the face of one of the myths that these people, these native peoples that were here, did not have a system of writing. The Ojibwe have sacred scrolls made of birch bark. And guess what? They go way, way back and they record history and events in detail. And they record the memories of older people in detail. They record the legends and folklore in detail. And they have it in writing on the sacred scrolls. Did you even know that existed? So, without further ado, Caleb, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. We are delighted to have you with us this evening. And, I just tried to bring you up on video. I see you on video, but the crowd that's watching doesn't, so we'll get that squared away. And right now, they'll just look at a picture. But welcome. We're glad to have you.
Are they able to hear me, at least?
Oh, yes, they can hear you.
fantastic. In fact, I think I can hear myself. I'll turn my speakers down a bit. Well, it's great to be here. This is, I think this is my first time on live radio, especially worldwide. This is kind of exciting.
Yeah, well, you know, it's your first time on live radio?
I did one small stint as a high schooler on a small radio show, but I didn't do much on it. It was just local radio, so this is my first time on a big radio station, or radio show at least.
Well, there's nothing like starting at the top.
Yeah, definitely. I was very surprised when I got a response back for this. This is kind of a dream come true, actually.
Well, but when I said we're delighted to have you, I very sincerely meant that. We are truly delighted to have you. And, you know, if you're nervous about it, you certainly are not showing it.
Oh, I've been doing a lot of video work on, I'm sure you know about YouTube. We've got a lot of videos on there, and I do a lot of public speaking with my job. So I'm quite used to talking to people. And in this situation, for me, it's just speaking you to you or me to you. It makes it a lot easier. So for everybody else listening, I might sound like an idiot, but for me, it just sounds like a normal conversation.
Well, and, you know, that's the way this whole thing is designed here. I've had a lot of people that have been on other shows that have commented about how much easier it was here. And I'm not saying that that makes it better, but it's just a telephone conversation between me and you is basically how we run it. So,
yeah.
All right. There are a lot of things about the Ojibwe that I think are important for people to know, and this is not an Ojibwe history lesson.
No, we don't want to
tonight,
get into that.
Because that's not what you're about. However, in order for people to sort of connect with the information that we're going to talk about tonight, I think they sort of need to understand the culture from which you come. This show, generally, we deal with UFOs, extraterrestrials, skinwalkers, Bigfoot, all of that stuff. So, folks, let me connect you up with the Ojibwe culture from our genre perspective. One of the stories, one of the creation story in the Ojibwe culture includes a story about Turtle Island. And does it surprise you that I know this?
No, it's actually it's a very common legend that a lot of people know about, but it's really refreshing to hear somebody mention it without me having to mention that first part. It's really cool to know that, actually.
Well, part of that story includes seven shining, iridescent beings that came out of the ocean.
Yep.
And talked to what this is after the Great Flood.
Yeah.
And we have a survivor who survived on a raft. And one of his names, he's called by several names, one of them is Nanabush, or Nanabush. Mm-hmm. And these seven beings, iridescent, shining beings, come up out of the ocean. And this is after land has reformed. And they set up five bands of people. And sort of like five clans. And one clan is like the bear clan or something like that. Each one has an animal.
Yes.
One of these beings was just way too spiritually overcharged, and people that got too near this being, it would kill them. The being didn't kill them, but just being too near the being would cause them to die. And so he went back into the ocean.
Yep.
The other six continued setting up these clans. And this is where the original clans of the nation came from, according to the creation story. You know, one of the really, really interesting things about that story is that, first of all, this universal story of a universal flood is there.
Definitely.
And then, whether people realize it or not, it is universal in ancient culture. The story of people coming up out of the water who were shining beings. You'll find that in almost every ancient culture.
Definitely.
And so you got to wonder, how did that happen all over the world? How did that flood thing happen all over the world unless these events were real? And that's my point, and that's where we're going to jump in talking with you. My point is that a whole lot of what we read from ancient cultures that we think is mythological is not. There may be some embellishment, but at the core, at the heart of it, is a real event that took place. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is how you take some of that, you take some of these ancient Ojibwe legends and lore, you bring them into a modern setting and write horror fiction.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
I wrote a book. It was based off of a lot of, in a way, dreams that I was having. I've had a lot of terror dreams since I was a kid, night terrors. And they kind of inspired me when I was a kid to try and write them out and get them out of my head so they're on a piece of paper and help me interpret what I was trying to see in my head as a kid sleeping. So I started taking the stories and trying to compare them to what the old stories were. Being raised fairly traditional, we believe that our dreams are really important. We believe that although the dream catcher exists and it originated with the Ojibwe people, we actually don't believe that it should stop a dream so much as that it should be a symbol of a web of life, a way of living your life. It's a philosophical symbol. To us, even a nightmare is important because it's telling you something that you need to know. So growing up, knowing that from my teachings, from my elders and my parents, I tried to figure out what was going on in my head, and often I was noticing a very interesting relation to a lot of the old legends. And in the last few while, the dreams started coming back, and I started having more dreams and more dreams. And so I started just taking the old stories and trying blending them into a current context. One guy said that it was a mix of, I'm not sure if you know his name, but Basil Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
An Ojibwe author. One of my friends described it as a mix of Basil Johnson with H.P. Lovecraft, and I found that quite amusing, actually. It was quite a funny description of it. The concept behind the stories is take the old stories and take the concepts behind them. The root, my cats are going crazy for some reason right now. If you hear some noise, that's them. Take the roots of all of them, the metaphors, the symbols, the symbolism behind them and the ideas behind them, and you can take those and put them into a modern context. You don't need all the old stuff per se, but if you can blend in the old things, the old stories of Wendigo, the old stories of Bear Walker, which is in a way the Ojibwe form of a skinwalker. Some people have described it as an Ojibwe form of a werewolf. My cat is going insane right now. An Ojibwe form of a werewolf and a lot of other witchcraft and everything else in there. You throw in all these different stories and you can put them into a more of a scary idea of what could happen right now. A lot of people read the old legends and they say, well, it's just an old story. It's just something that doesn't happen anymore. They look at kind of Aesop's fables. They're just little metaphors and symbols that you need to know to live a good life. Well, the fact of the matter is our people believe in those legends. We believe that that's what happened. We do believe that when Creator made this world, it was put on the back of a turtle. We do believe that. If you look at North America, oddly enough, it looks like a snapping turtle in a lot of ways. You've got Alaska and Newfoundland as the front legs. You've got Mexico as the back tail. And if you look at a snapping turtle's tail, it does look like a big, meaty piece of flesh. That kind of looks like Mexico on the rest of this turtle. Florida and California make the hind legs, and then the Arctic Islands make the head of the snapping turtle. And the rest of North America, well, there's your shell. It's a very amazing coincidence that even kids notice. When I'm coming into their classrooms and talking about that legend and they see that map right behind them of the entire world, I'll get like two or three hands coming up and pointing at the map saying, is that the turtle right there? And so you can see it. You can actually see the symbolism there. You can see the stories. We truly understand these things and believe in them. We find things in them that make sense to us, and that's how we interpret them. Your Bible stories from Christianity, your legends from the Old Testament and the Torah, they all have... In our belief, and a lot of people's beliefs, they have some sort of meaning. As you described with that flood, there's a lot of things that could have possibly happened. A very good example is, I mention it in one of my stories in the book. It's called Madness of the Manitou. Tales from Within, that's the title of the book. One of my stories, Dancer of the Raven Mask. There's a story in there about Bibbon. And Bibbon is a spirit in our culture that's about the spirit of winter and snow and ice. And an old legend of ours is a long time ago, Nanabush, the gentleman that survived the flood, he actually got too cocky because he was half Manitou. He was half spirit, and he believed that he was one of the most powerful beings on the planet. and that upset a lot of other Manitou, and one of them was Bibbon. And Bibbon said to him, no, you're not stronger than me, and I'll prove it. And he turned himself into a large sheet of ice and pushed Manibush down and down and down further and further into the southern parts of Turtle Island. Now, if you think about it, you will want to read that and think, wow, that's some crazy little story. But if you look at ancient history, 14,000 years ago, there was a glacier that shoved all the way down almost into the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
And story keeps that story going. That concept, we had that historical text describing in our Birchbark Scrolls, a glacier over nearly a mile thick, just moving slowly like a, I think one of my texts that I was reading from my archaeology work, it could move up to a meter a day. Mm-hmm. Which is about a yard a day. That's a lot of ground covered in just a few years.
Well, you know, along the same line, the same theme of knowledge, same stream of knowledge that we're talking about here, these ancient legends, as I said, they may be embellished.
Mm-hmm.
At the core is the real event, and it's not fiction. At the core, it's not fiction. At the core, it's reality. Now, really interesting thing here is this creation story of the Ojibwe includes talking about how land was reformed, that there was water everywhere, and there were some animals on this raft with Nanibush.
Yep.
And each one, he tried to dive down and get some sand off the bottom of, well, I guess we could say ocean at that point. And it was way too far down. He couldn't go down. And a crane says he's going to go down and try. And he tries. He doesn't get it. And finally, it's a muskrat that gets mm-hmm. it. He goes down and he gets some of the sand. But he's gone for a very long time. He comes back up. He has some of the sand, but he dies.
Yeah.
Because he was without air for so long. And so the muskrat is honored among the Ojibwe, and Earth honors the muskrat. Okay, but then Nanibush takes this sand, and he puts it on the raft and lets it dry out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he forms it into, and listen to this, folks, he forms it into a ball, into a globe.
Mm-hmm.
And he sets it spinning. And then he sets it into the water spinning and commands it to grow. And it begins to grow. Okay. Are you ready, folks? Did you know there's something very similar to that right there in the Bible? Yeah, you knew you weren't going to get away without me saying something about that, right? Okay. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from this break, I'll tell you about that.
And you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Caleb Musgrave, and Caleb, as we went away for break, I said that there's something similar to that right there in the Bible. Now, you don't know, but our listeners know, I'm not a religious person, but I read all kinds of texts. As you well know from what we've been talking about tonight, I read everybody's texts. But in Genesis chapter 1, it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth."
Mm-hmm.
Genesis chapter 2, in English it says, "And the earth was without form and void." Negative. That isn't what it says. That's a bad English translation. because it's Hayah, or Hayah, some people say, Tohu Vabohu. And what that means is, when it says Hayah, they translate it was, Tohu Vabohu, without form and void. Hayah does not mean was. The translation of Hayah is became. It became formless and void. And then your 6 days of creation. Interesting, isn't it, that you have six iridescent beings that come up out of the waters in the Ojibwe creation story. So you have 6 days of creation, and during this 6 days of creation, this mass of mess that's out there just in waters, because the earth existed and then it was just blown apart some way, and you have this mass of mess and water.
Mm-hmm.
And during the 6 days, it begins to coalesce and be put back together, and dry land then appears, and it's put back together as what, folks? A globe. What do the Ojibwe say?
The exact same.
A globe. At the time the Ojibwe were talking about it being a globe, Europe was talking about the earth being flat. They didn't know.
Yeah.
Interesting, isn't it? So there's a lot of reality, and you have to wonder, Caleb, how did they know? How did the Ojibwe know? It's a globe. When all of the doctors and PhDs in Europe said it was flat.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of belief and a lot of interesting theories as to why the Ojibwe had a lot of, I suppose you could use them as theories as to what the world looked like, and fairly accurate theories. The fact that they knew the North America looked in the form of a turtle, the fact that if you look at the Serpent Mound of the Ohio Valley, they're coming more and more evidence now that Algonquin language culture, pre-Algonquin language culture, were the ones that were creating the mounds. So Algonquin language is what the Ojibwe, the Cree, Blackfoot, pretty much of Canada and a good deal of the northern United States and even some of the southern United States are Algonquin language. They're getting more and more evidence that it was Algonquin linguistics groups that may have formed a lot of these mounds, burial mounds, and of course the Serpent Mound of the Ohio Valley. And you talk to anybody and they'll tell you that the best way to see that mound is from up in the sky. And the same with down in, I believe it's the Nazca lines or the Nazca's lines.
Mm-hmm.
Group.
Yeah.
Same thing. They say you have to be quite high up to actually be able to see these things.
You know, there's one in Louisiana, too, a serpent mound like that in Louisiana as well.
Where I live right now, we're actually, my reserve, my community, we're the guardians of serpent mounds. And it's actually several mounds that make a serpentine shape looking like it's a snake coming in and out of the water. Uh-huh. And it's just a 5-minute drive down the road from where I live right now. And we're up in, I'm in central Canada.
All right.
Central Ontario.
Now, which reserve, which band of the Ojibwe are the keepers of the sacred scrolls?
Mostly it's up north. The reason being is that's where a lot of the culture kept alive during the oppression that happened when... there's a lot of different moments of oppression that happened in history here in Canada. But mostly when the residential schools came in and a lot of the oppression of religion came in, they told us that we couldn't practice Sundance, we couldn't practice the old ceremonies, it was illegal. And when that happened, we simply took our scrolls, bundled them up, and sent them away and hid them. And the places that were the hardest for the Indian agents and for the police to get to was high up in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, a lot of the scroll keepers are up in the northern areas. Now, I do know that back home where I grew up in Saugeen First Nation, which is over on Lake Huron, anybody from there, hi. But we've got people there that have read the scrolls, and they're just over on the Bruce Peninsula, which is part of Lake Huron. It's only about a 2-hour drive from the U.S. border, maybe 3 or 4 hour drive. I can't remember how long it was, actually. But they're not too far away from the American border. And even there, they have people that read the scrolls. That's the first time I ever saw a scroll was when I was about 15 years old, and it was right there in front of me with a native elder from, I believe it was Wequemacong, which is part of Manitoulin Island, which is a little further up north on Lake Huron where Georgian Bay meets. And the scrolls are very common up there, and up there you have what's called the Medewin or the Medewiwin. And the Medewiwin are the Medicine Society. It's one of the largest, I suppose you could say it's like the Vatican of the Ojibwe people with a lot of our religion. And it is religion, it's not necessarily just a spirituality. You have your personal faith. And then beyond there, there are certain sects of religious groups that you could be a member of if you decide to. You could be, and of course, if they want you, that's the more important question, really, in the end. You have Society of the Dawn, which is, the pronunciation changes with each community, but it's usually Wabagamoan. And you got the Midewin or the Midewiwin, which is the Great Heart Society or the Good Heart Society or the Good People Society. And then you have Sundance, which is more well known with the plains. And when it came into Canada and came into Ontario mostly, it became what was called the Rain Dance. And the reason for that is actually a legal thing. Was when Canada made the law that you cannot have a Sundance, the Ojibwe people said, okay, we'll just call it a Rain Dance then. We didn't stop our ceremonies because they wanted us to. We just changed the name so they couldn't get us in trouble. And that is quite common. That's what I'm a member of. I'm a member of the Rain Dance people up in Manitoulin Island. And
well,
there's also
Manitou,
other smaller things.
Manitou actually means, it's an Algonquin word for God, right? It's a god.
Yeah, it's a rough form. There's different levels. There's Gijem Nado or Gitche Manitou, which is the more common name. Like, if you ever heard the Huron Christmas Carol, that's where Gitche Manitou comes from. That means the great spirit or the great god or the great deity.
Mm-hmm.
Manitou is a word that usually translates in the English language as spirit or deity. But there's really no genuine translation. It's more something that's internal, that when you hear the word Manitou and you're Ojibwe, or as we call ourselves, Anishinaab or Anishinaabe, when you hear the word Manitou or Minadu, as it's often pronounced up north, it's something that hits you a little bit more deep than the word God or the word deity. It's something internalized more than externalized, I suppose, as you can describe it. The word Manitou, I guess, is the best way you can externalize the feeling of it. It's something because we believe creation is what God is. It's all life is God. And it flows through all of us. I think the Apache people, they call Creator, or they call God, or they call Allah, or Jehovah, whatever you wish to call him or her, the spirit that moves through all things. And that's a very good way of describing what Manitou means. It's a spirit that is within all things. But to us, Manitou gets divided. There's different types of Manitou. Demigods, I suppose, is a good way to describe it.
Well, the Ojibwe had contact. I mean, the Ojibwe spread out from the northeastern side of the Americas all the way across to the west coast.
Yeah.
And had contact, you know, even with, like, the Mi'kmaq. They called those the Allied Brothers.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. See, my neighbor's Mi'kmaq. He's, my neighbor's friend. He lives there pretty much all the time. He's Mi'kmaq from Nova Scotia. And they call themselves Mi'kmaq, but we call them Little Brother or Friendly Brother.
Uh-huh.
And then there's Abenaki. The Abenaki are well known for the French Indian Wars, being on the side of the French during the Rogers Rangers battles. Abenaki actually comes from Wabanki, which is actually an Ojibwe word for the eastern direction, or the place where the sun rises.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Wabanki comes from, or Abenaki. So the Ojibwe language, in fact, was the lingua franca of quite a bit of North America for well over a century, all the way to our language becoming a pidgin talk for traders that were going all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, up into the Arctic. The word Pasadena, there's Pasadena, Texas, and I think there's even a... I don't know my American geography very well, but I think there's a Pasadena, California.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Pasadena comes from Pasadena, which is Ojibwe for the foggy sound, which is a bay-like area.
Mm.
So the Ojibwe language spread out and took over quite a bit because of the trade networks and all the connections that we had with all of our allies.
The reason I'm spending time talking about all of this, there are two reasons. And the main reason is so that everyone listening will understand that our modern culture and many of the words, many of the names of places, and even many of the things that people believe right now, they're not divorced from what was here in the past. They're standing on the shoulders of what was here in the past. Now, what was here in the past? Well, first, let me say that even with the hardships that the Ojibwe people suffered under colonization, you're just darn lucky you weren't colonized by the conquistadors. Because those people, man, they came in, they burned everything. If they had found any of the scrolls, they would have burned them.
It would have been wiped out. I work a lot with archaeologists, and I work a lot with anthropologists, and even paleobotanists and ethnobotanists. And there's a plant down in the Matstican area, I think it's called Ololiuqui, It's a member of the Morning Glory family. It's a very powerful hallucinogen that was used by the tribes down there in the Mazatecan areas of Mesoamerica. And when the conquistadors came in, they knew that this plant was important, so they burned it. They wiped it out. And then somewhere in the 1960s, a botanist came across a plant that looked a lot like the drawings they had seen in old texts. And they asked the local native what this was, and they said, it's Ololiuqui. And the person said, no, that's extinct. And they said, what, you think it just grew in the farms? It's a wild plant. It's not like the conquistadors ran through the forest looking for every plant they could find that looked like it.
Mm-hmm.
But they did a heavy-duty job on devastating the cultures down there. Heavy-duty job.
Yeah.
I count my blessings for Cortez not coming up here.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah. But now, the thing that flows from that fact is that the culture, and as you've already touched on this, the Algonquin language, but also sort of the common things in the Algonquin culture, the related nations, it was not as if there was an empire of these folks across America. Nevertheless, the language and many of the beliefs and stories, many of the practices sort of seeped out through all of North America. And you can find traces of it just everywhere you go. In all of the Native American or First Nations people, you can find traces of this contact with the Algonquin culture. Algonquin would, if think of the Algonquin folks, think of that like an umbrella.
Yeah.
Okay, and then under that you have a bunch of different clans or tribes or nations, and the Ojibwe is one of those. But there's a common language. Okay, now it will be different from nation to nation, like English. Okay, I can go to Australia, and with difficulty, you folks in Australia can understand me because I am speaking a type of English. The same thing if I go to England, if I go to Ireland. And when I hear people from those places, with difficulty, I can understand what they're saying. I pick up most of it. I do have to admit the Irish are a bit difficult for me. Seriously, but I can pick up what they're talking about. And it kind of works that way. Now, when we come back, I want to get into how some of these ancient legends have anything at all to do with our current world and surviving our current world. So we'll do that when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Caleb Musgrave, and we've been talking about the Ojibwe history and Ojibwe culture, Ojibwe being a group of native people who were living here many, 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 many centuries before somebody finally discovered America. When they discovered the New World, there were ancient cultures already here. But, you know, one of the things that was kind of a surprise, by the way, to the Europeans who first encountered the Ojibwe is that, first of all, the Ojibwe people were wearing very expensive-looking clothing because the clothing was made of animal skins. Very expensive in Europe. Mainly, I think, it varied from place to place, but a lot of moose skin, tanned hides. And they were, I don't know that you would use the word embroidered, but sort of, very decoratively with colored beads. And very fancy, and it was quite impressive to the Europeans. They really were a little bit taken back by the high level of sophistication and civilization. And they were also a bit taken aback when they discovered that there was writing.
Yeah.
But let's move beyond that. Let's get into this whole concept that these ancient legends actually do play a role in the world in which we live. A lot of these ancient legends, Caleb, talk about calamitous events happening.
Yes.
And then the people having to survive that and how they survived it. And one of the things you do is you are an instructor. I forget the name of the institute that you work with, but you're an instructor teaching people how to survive off the land after there's been a calamity of some sort. Tell us about that.
I'm one of the head instructors at Canadian Bushcraft. It's the word bushcraft is actually from the southern hemisphere, mostly Australia and Africa. It means skills in the woods. Up here we'd call it woodcraft or wilderness survival is a very common term, though it's a little bit more umbrella than what it should be for the term. It's too generic. We teach the concept that no matter what the situation, you can stay alive if you use the right things in your head and the right things in your pack. If you have the right things on your body, such as the right kind of equipment, the right kind of clothing, and you have a cool head on you and you can use common sense, usually you can get out alive with no problems. You might have a kind of uncomfortable night through the sleep, but usually you can get through quite fine. Some of these kind of emergencies that can happen could simply be your car breaking down on the back roads when you're trying to go out somewhere during Christmas, which happens actually quite frequently. I believe it was last year around Christmas time, or maybe a little closer to spring, that a poor couple from Canada was actually trying to travel down to Las Vegas, took the wrong back road, and ended up with the husband dying and the wife barely staying alive after several days of people searching, almost, I believe it was several weeks, actually, of people looking for them. Mm-hmm. The proper training can keep them alive in that kind of a situation. That's really the main one that we have happening. The biggest emergency that happens in Canada for people going missing in the woods or getting stranded is hunters. You deal with a lot of people. I think it's about just shy of 1,000 people a year getting stranded in the woods here in the Canadian wilderness. And it's often just hunters getting lost. Sometimes it's anglers, sometimes it's trappers. Very rarely, though, is it hikers. Usually a hiker knows where they're going. They stick to trails. They have a map and compass with them, and they usually know how to use it. Mm-hmm. And often they ask questions. Whereas hunters, they rarely do any of those things. They often go out to far distant areas that they don't know very well, but they just know that there's going to be wild game there. They don't often ask for directions when they get out there. They don't often know how to use a map, and if they did, they might not even have one with them.
You know, that's a very basic skill that most people don't have anymore, and that is how to use a map. Folks, I'm not talking about a road map either. I mean, if you've got one, good, but what if the roads are gone? Or what if you have to go into an area where there are no roads to escape the calamity, whatever it may be? You need a topographical map, and you need a compass, and you need to know how to read that map and that compass. Now, you might think, well, a compass points north. Yeah, but a map doesn't. Okay. Exactly. It does. Actually, the map points north and the compass points to magnetic north. Mm-hmm. And so your map, in order to be accurate, you have to know the degrees by which that map is off of magnetic north.
Yep.
And that changes with your location. The further south you go, the further east you go, the further west you go, and so forth. It changes. And so just map reading, do you teach map reading as part of your survival skills?
We do teach map reading. We don't go into too heavy detail of bushwhacking it because it's just a lot of work. You have to actually spend a whole day, and we do offer orienteering classes on occasion. There's other schools in Ontario where we are that teach much better orienteering than I can. When I look at a map and a compass, I just know what I'm doing after years of using them. Mm-hmm. It's hard to interpret that. What we often do, aside from that, from just simple map and compass, we show you natural techniques using a stick and the shadows from the sun to help give you an orientation of east to west. Mm-hmm. We teach you to use natural navigation, is often the term we use, nature's navigation or nature's compass. Up here in the Canadian boreal forest, you have pileated woodpeckers, which are giant woodpeckers, that drill square holes in the trees. And this is just a simple example. They're going to sit there and peck this giant hole out of a tree. They don't want to be in the middle of the windstorm, so they often go to the leeward side of a tree. And in Ontario, the prevailing winds are in the northwest. So you know that a pileated woodpecker, 9 times out of 10, is going to put its holes on the southeastern side of a tree. And that's a very simple way of describing it. There's other ones that are old wives' tales, like moss growing on the north side of a tree. You go out here in the Canadian woods, you find moss everywhere on a tree. You find it hanging from the trees.
Yeah.
But there's other ones out there that happen. The sun, the stars, these ones I often use with our students. And it's a very simple way.
Tell us what should be in a person's basic kit.
Oh.
Okay? Look, let me set the story, okay, before we do this. Here's the scenario, folks. Yesterday, well, I don't know what happened there, but we'll get rid of that. Yesterday, we had some big earthquakes that happened not just in just one place. They happened all up the western coast. It was, you know, Mexico right on up into the, off the coast of Oregon, I believe.
Yep.
And some minor quakes then in Alaska. A whole bunch of minor quakes, but in Alaska. Okay, so let's say that tomorrow it happens again, but it's not offshore. We'll say that tomorrow it happens again, and it's onshore, and now there's no electricity where you are, and you know, there's pretty much chaos in terms of, you know, with no electricity, there's not going to be radio. With no electricity, there's not going to be television, no internet. The cell system is probably going to be down if there's no electricity at all. And even if it's up, you're not going to talk to too many people before you run out of battery, and then you can't recharge. You have no lights. Now, the stores are closed for their own safety. They have to close. What are you going to do? Okay, so what should we have in our kit, Caleb?
Well, the first thing that should be done is prepare ahead of time. Your kit, if it's an emergency that happens, such as an earthquake, I'm going to assume that you're either in a vehicle or at a building, such as your house or your work. I'm not going to guess that we're out in the middle of the back 40 for this one.
Okay.
In an urban setting for survival, the same rules apply as what happens in the woods. You have 3 seconds of clear thought before you're going to have an accident. If you're swerving on the road and a car comes flying into your lane, you have 3 seconds or less, usually less, to react and get out of there safely before killing yourself or someone else. You have 3 minutes of air before your brain starts to shut down. And these are just rough rules that we call the rules of three. 3 minutes without air before your brain starts to shut down. After 5 minutes, you should often be, or you usually are, brain dead. You have 3 hours of protection from the elements. Though in that 3 hour period, if you're out in the cold, if you're out in the wind, if you're out in the rain, in the snow, and of course out in the heat, I'm talking about my friends down in Arizona or even in the California regions, you're dealing with extreme heat in this period.
Mm-hmm.
So you need protection within 3 hours before you die of what's called exposure to the elements. And exposure to the elements is either hyperthermia or hypothermia. So freezing to death or heat stroke. Those are the two things that usually get somebody.
All right, hang on. We have to take a break, and we'll pick up right there when we come back. Don't forget where you are, because that's where we'll pick up. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Caleb Musgrave. Those of you who are joining just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you are here. My sincere sympathy for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour, because you really have missed, and I mean missed, a universe or two of information. And we are now moving, we've been talking about the ancient Ojibwe culture, Ojibwe being one of the Native American First Nations who were here when the Europeans came over and said, hey, look what we found. So we've been talking about that culture and some of the legends and how that plays right into our present day. Now, our guest this evening, Caleb Musgrave, is Ojibwe. And he is also, he is an author. He writes horror fiction using Ojibwe ancient legends and bringing them into a modern context. But he also teaches survival. He teaches when everything breaks down and your modern culture is, your modern civilization is smoldering around you or gone, how do you survive? And I pose the question, let's say that all those big earthquakes that happened yesterday happen tomorrow, and they happen, we'll say they happen on land. Folks, don't go say that I predicted it. Okay? It's a hypothetical. What if it does happen? Well, if it does, and all of our gadgetry around us is non-functional, then what? How do you survive that? And this is what he teaches this. As a matter of fact, Caleb, we'll get back to that discussion that we were in, but when we talked today on the telephone, you said that because it's 2012, actually business teaching survival has picked up, and you nice. Have noticed that with other survival schools as well, right?
Uh-huh. I remember there's a, my speaker's getting loud again. There was a gentleman who just passed away past June, God rest his soul, Ron Hood. He started a lot of the survival businesses by starting survival.com and the Hoodlums forum, as well as the Woodsmaster series. And again, Ron, I offer a lot of credit towards that man for helping educate myself and a lot of other instructors out there. When he was really popular was in the 1990s, especially the last few years of the 1990s. And his popularity grew and grew and grew the closer they got to the year 2000. Do you see a pattern happening here?
Sure. Yeah, 2000, everybody was worried about Y2K.
Exactly. And he said during the last 6 months of his, before Y2K, one of the reports that I heard from him, one of his little articles, mentioned that pretty much a year's worth of work happened in that six-month period. It doubled in business.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of business for an instructor when suddenly your work doubles in a half the time. We've been having an increase in a surplus of people asking us, and almost every single class we have, people say, what are you going to do if the zombies come? What are you going to do when this comes? What are you going to do when this comes? It's like pretty much the same thing each time. You just switch and tweak it a little bit to fit the scenario, because the rules always remain the same. And it's astounding that as we get closer and closer to December of 2012, I'm predicting, just as you didn't predict earlier, but I am predicting that there will be an increase with a lot of schools. I'm going to see an increase on video viewings on YouTube, I'm sure, with my channel, Canadian Bushcraft, as well as other people's YouTube channels, Dave Canterbury, for instance, my friend John Campbell down in Arizona. I see a prediction of increase of video views there. Magazines are going to increase, books, the SAS Survival Guide. I think it's got a few million copies sold by this point. I think there's going to be at least another million sold before 2012 comes along. And my prediction is simply it's going to pass us by just like Y2K passed us by. Nothing really is going to happen. I say that simply because our teachings are, many of my elders believe in what's called the Thunderbird calendar, which is another one of those calendars that are out there, just like the Mayan calendar that are out there, that is an Ojibwe calendar, because we didn't just keep tally by writing, but we actually had numerology, we had numbers. We had time, we had a 13-moon calendar, or 13-month calendar, each month being 28 days, 28 times 13, you got 365 days.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, I believe that was very much like the traditional Roman calendar before the Greek calendar came into it. I'm not very good on my ancient European history. I'll have to look into that before I can vouch for it. But
well,
our calendar actually states that we have about another 50,000 years before any huge calamity could possibly happen to the world. Like, huge calamity. I'm talking, like, full-on economic, not economic collapse, but full-on sun-goes-out kind of economic...
An earthbuster.
Yeah, something that just wipes us out. We got a long time before that happens. What we teach is that, just as in our school, the rule is it's not the big thing that gets you. It's rarely the grizzly bear that kills you in the woods. It's the little things that happen to you as you go along. You drop your survival blanket, which is a little Mylar sheet you can wrap around like tinfoil on a baked potato. You drop that, and your lighter gets wet. Those two things combined can kill you. Just those two little things can kill you. It's not the grizzly bear. It's the little things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at it, and I think, well, you want to look at disasters. I live here in Ontario, Canada. I live in central Ontario, and just east of me in the mid-1990s or late 1990s, I was a kid at the time, so I'm only 23. I know, scary. But...
I'm only 18, but I've got a lot of miles on me.
I remember in the mid-90s, there was an ice storm that hit eastern Ontario and western Quebec, and I think part of the northern part of New York. I can't recall that part if it was for sure or not. And people died.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was by the accident of trying to drive on black ice, or one of the big trees that's covered in ice finally breaks and comes down on their house, or it was the little things. It wasn't the actual ice that killed them. It was the things that happened that just collected and collected and collected and caused calamity. It's the little things. If that earthquake happens, if you survive the earthquake, great. Most people do. It's the injuries that happen with it. I believe one of my friends, he's a survival instructor in California, where there's the San Andreas Fault Line. He was talking about one of the biggest causes of death after an earthquake is fire. From the gas leaks,
mm-hmm.
from electrical sparks hitting the gas, of course, from car collisions, from everything else that could happen, all these crazy little things that happen. That's what gets most a lot of people killed, is they stay in the house. But at the same time, we teach people when an emergency happens, you stay put. So it's kind of contradicting each other. A lot of things change. So for us, going back to the rules of three, you got 3 seconds without clear thought, 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without protection from the elements, and that protection from the elements you could put back into the heat, fire. So you got to get away from danger of fire in that situation with an earthquake. Not finally, but 3 days without water, and that's clean water. We're not just talking about drinking it out of the town pond. We're talking about getting it clean, and that means disinfected and purified so you can digest it safely.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much finally is 3 weeks without food, up to 40 days without food you can survive. You look at Gandhi, everybody thinks it's a miracle. People, I've met 3 or 4 people in my lifetime that have done 43 days without food, and they had some kidney problems eventually over time, but they survived no problem.
Mm-hmm.
The final genuine one that everybody talks about, and it's kind of, some people believe and some people don't, is 3 months without human companionship. And you look at the movie Castaway, you see Wilson the volleyball, that's what happens to you after 3 months without human companionship. You start to lose it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you follow that rules, the rules of 3 seconds without air, clear thought, 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food, and 3 months without companionship, you see what your priorities are. You need to think clearly first and foremost, and then get safe. Mm-hmm. And once you're safe, you need to start thinking about water long before you start thinking about food. I was going to mention that I have food stocked downstairs. I'm not a prepper. A lot of people have been talking about that there's a National Geographic show that was on called Doomsday Preppers. And there's some people on there that have like 6 years' supply of food stocked downstairs. But I have a greenhouse. I have a garden. We grow our own vegetables here. In the next few weeks, we're going to be building a rabbit hutch to raise our own meats here. We're putting in a tank to raise perch in as well.
Mm-hmm.
We take care of ourselves, and there's more than just the idea of the world's going to collapse. If I grow all my own food and raise my own food, I don't have to pay grocery bills.
Mm-hmm.
So that's more of a common sense thing to me. I have the land here to do so, so I do it. And also, if my neighbor has a problem, say they lose their job, or say that economic collapse that everybody's always talking about with the recession that's been happening, with the history of the Depression way back, everybody's worried about some sort of economic collapse more than anything else right now, and peak oil, of course. Me, I think that as long as you think positive and everybody else in the world tries to think positive, that's not too much of an issue, because when people are happy, they buy things. But going with that, we raise our own food. If our neighbor gets a problem where they break their leg and they can't work for 2 months, we can supply them with food if they need it. We help each other out in communities. And that's really something that is important, I think, in an earthquake scenario, or say Katrina happens tenfold, or a tsunami hits, just like what happened way back in 2005, I believe it was, when the tsunami hit around Christmas time. Something like that happens, community often saves people. It's people working together and keeping each other okay. One person has clean drinking water or a method of getting the water clean. They share that, and everybody else that has food shares with them, and everybody that has protective materials. And the idea of trying to prepare for an earthquake, with your priorities being listed out, community should be part of your escape plan and your emergency plan. You need to have either a family or a neighborhood. It could just be your apartment complex if need be. You need to have something there to work together with. You can't just rely on yourself. People that try to rely on just themselves, they're usually the ones that you find face down floating in the water after the flood.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you can be put into a situation where you have to rely on yourself because there's nobody else around at that moment.
It happens with the hunters all the time up here.
Yeah, but and you have to be able to do that. But then once you kind of get that going, you need to get to where there are other people.
Exactly. Or of course, hope for those people to find you. And that's what we teach with the whole idea of staying put. You put up signals. You try and make yourself, in a sense, as obnoxious as possible so they can't miss you. If you're making a bunch of noise and you're making a bunch of colors flying in the air, if you've got a bunch of orange jackets and stuff from hunters and you're waving them over your head, blowing a whistle and screaming with a big fire full of smoke, chances are that nine times out of ten, they're probably going to see you. And usually, if they're not too annoyed, they're probably going to come over and try and help you. Mm-hmm. But in an emergency such as the earthquake scenario, chances are there's going to be at least two or three other people there with you. The scenario that I always give to people is it's your family. So say that you're married to whether it's a wife or a husband and you have two kids. Mm-hmm. If you're the only person, if you're doing the whole gung-ho, I'm going to be the only person that knows this stuff and I'm going to train myself and train myself and train myself. Say you're the one that has wilderness first response training. That's great until you're the one that's incapacitated.
Mm-hmm.
If your kid doesn't know how to use an AED or know how to do CPR or just simple first aid, you actually could be in more trouble than you think. If you think you're the responsible adult and you think the kid should just be sitting back and letting you handle the situation, we've actually had scenarios in history in Canada and the States where a kid doing the Heimlich maneuver saved a woman's life in a Burger King.
Mm-hmm.
So scenarios like that, with the equipment concept of all the priorities, I put community and family into that equipment list. You need to have something to make water safe. You need something to keep yourself safe from the elements, whether that be that Mylar sheet, that emergency blanket, or my preference is a wool blanket. They're a little heavier, but they have a lot more insulative value to me. And if somebody's in shock, I can wrap them up in it. They feel a lot more safe and secure. And as the shock starts to wear off their bodies, as they're shivering like crazy with that shock happening, chances are that wool blanket's going to help them. If I have the Mylar, I can put that on there as well and make it even warmer for them.
Mm-hmm.
A container is often something that I suggest people have, simply a metal container. It could be just a coffee can, obviously a metal coffee can. The reason being is there's so many things you can do that you can carry the kid in it. Some people have bug-out bags. I'm sure you've heard the term.
Oh, I have. I used to be international police, and we got every place we got sent, we had to have a bug-out bag in case we had to evacuate. And there was one time where we did have to evacuate. And I have continued that practice. So, you know, if the ground begins to shake as I'm speaking to you, me and my bug-out bag are out of here.
Yeah. The way that we teach it is bug-out bags are great if you are needing to be on the move. My philosophy is if there's an earthquake and I know that my house is stable, structurally sound, and the earthquake is done, I don't think there's going to be another earthquake coming. The broadcast that I do have on my little ham radio or whatever I may have with me, I can crank that little dynamo thing and listen in. They say there's no more earthquakes that are expected, but emergencies are going to continue on through the night. I'll just bug in. I'll stay put, just as we teach our students. If there's an emergency where I think there's a gas leak, I think another earthquake's coming, and this place is definitely not stable, I'm going to try and get to a place that I know is going to be safe. Up here in Ontario, we don't have much of an earthquake scenario danger, as such as somebody would have down in the San Andreas Fault, so I can't tell you exactly where that safe place would be. That's not my forte when it comes to survival. Up here, my forte is cold weather. We have people every year, frostbite, frostnip, hypothermia. It happens all the time in Canada. Two or three years ago, a guy decided to be like Les Stroud, Survivor Man, and take off into the woods with barely anything, and a week later, they find his body.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it was around actually this time of year, just about a month, maybe about 3 weeks, a month away from earlier than right now. That's a bad time to be out in the cold. You're dealing with warm weather and wet weather.
You know, I have stuff around me all the time that is for the purpose of, okay, what if this goes down? Now, as an example, you can't see this, but those who are watching our TV channel can. That's about half of a candle. Now, the reason that's half of a candle is because I was sitting in here working one night when the electricity went down. Remember that, folks? Remember me telling you about that? And I had Jerry Wills, our associate host, had to do the show on Monday night that week. And why? Because our electricity was down here, okay? When the electricity goes out here, I have to have light in here anyway. And so this is half a candle from when that electricity went down. And right here on the desk with it, that's a lighter, okay? And when the lights go out, it may be the night the lights went out in Georgia, but here I've got light, okay?
Right here.
Now,
this one of lighter.
Yep.
Flashlight.
Yeah, here's right here on the desk. There's, let me hold it here where you can see it, folks. There's my little flashlight. Now, here's the reason I'm talking about this evening. We get quite a bit of email from around the world. And the closer we get to December the 21st, 2012, the more email I get where people are worried. Okay? And I don't make fun of that. Like you, I have said, I think the significance of December the 21st is it's the day before December the 22nd.
Exactly.
I think that's the significance. But, folks, you've also heard me say, I could be wrong. It may be that on December the 21st, the planet rocks and rolls. It could be.
Could very well.
And the point is, even though I don't think that's going to be the case, I'm ready as I can be, in case it is the case. And you see, it has nothing to do with what do you believe. It has to do with do you want to live?
Exactly. Okay. We have a saying in our company that's actually I borrowed it from another man. A lot of people know him as the co-star of the show Dual Survival from the Discovery Channel, Cody Lundin.
Okay.
He has a saying that he kind of borrowed it and turned it around from the Boy Scouts, and I like it. I like his version more than the Boy Scouts, and that's be prepared, not scared.
That is good.
It's a beautiful way of looking at it. If you have the right equipment and the right know-how, you can get by with a lot of problems. I've at my house, I think I've gone, in 1 year of staying in this house, I think I've gone with 5 power outages. And I just sit there with my candles. On some occasions, I've taken a tuna can, an old used tuna can, put in a piece of paper cloth or paper towel, filled it up with some olive oil, and made myself a little oil lamp and kept on writing right beside it.
Sure, you can do that. And if you have cleaning alcohol, in other words, you know, not just rubbing alcohol, cleaning alcohol, you can cook. And the fumes that it gives off, H2O. Okay?
I'm trying to remember the other item I had here that's a great thing to have. A little cooking device is always great. I just remember where I put it. I have it in my kit back at my camp where we teach, actually.
Okay.
It's called an Emberlit stove. They're a great little thing to have. I think they're one of the finest devices for cooking and trying to purify water, because the easiest way to purify water, at least disinfect it, is to boil it. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks you got to boil it for 10 minutes, 5 minutes. What do you need to do? At any elevation, this is the simple rule, once it gets to boiling temperature, to a rolling boil, any pathogen that we know of is pretty much practically killed.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get it to rolling boil, you can leave it there for a minute. You can leave it there for the 5 minutes. It's really not going to change much. The only thing that's going to change is you have less water in there because it's evaporating.
Yeah.
So once you get it to about boiling, when you get it to that rolling boil temperature, you can take it off, and it's going to stay hot for a while. It's going to have to take a while to cool down. So even during that time of cooling down, it's going to stay around 80 degrees Celsius for quite a while. 100 degrees Celsius is where it starts to boil. 80 degrees Celsius is where it's going to stay for a while. And if you can get it to 80 degrees Celsius for half an hour, you just pasteurized your water.
Yeah.
So we look at it that way.
Yeah, well, boiling, you know, you can even foodstuffs that you think, well, this might be contaminated. Boil it.
Yeah.
You know, boil it.
It's a simple thing. Cooking. I've dealt with, this is going to sound maybe disturbing to some of your listeners, but I've eaten roadkill on multiple occasions. And if you're kind of squeamish about it, cook it longer.
Yeah, there you go.
That's pretty much the rule we have is if you find something and it's dead and it doesn't look diseased, but it looks like it's been there for a while, like it's been there for more than maybe 2 hours, you cook it longer. That's the simple rule. Is you can get it. I'm not saying that. I'm not telling people to go out there and find a skunk and cook it right now. That's not what I'm suggesting.
Well, you can, though. You can eat virtually anything.
Yeah, I've eaten vulture. I've eaten, this is going to sound weird, but I've eaten owl. I've eaten quite a few crazy, I'm sure you can call them delicacies somewhere in the world.
Oh, I've had rat. I've had bat.
Yep.
You know. I've had various types of snakes. Okay, I want to open this conversation to our audience. And, ladies and gentlemen, the telephone lines are open. Caller, you just hang with me for a moment and don't hang up, and I'll put you on line here in just a second. The telephone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. If you're in Canada or the USA, please use that number and give us a call. If you're anywhere else in the world, you can call that number, but we know it can be expensive to make an international call. So we have an additional way for you to get in touch with us if you're outside of the USA or Canada. And that is go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down till you see this picture about tonight's show, and right above that picture is a link that says Flash Message. So you can use that to send me your question or comment. Now let's go to the telephone. Caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
First name is Troy, calling from Newfoundland.
Hello, Troy.
Hello, Kevin. Hello, Caleb.
Hello, from the Maritimes. Hello, my friend.
Hello. I got a question for you, Caleb. I'm just wondering what you know about the relationship that Native Americans have with ancient aliens or extraterrestrials.
There's quite a few. I was actually doing a lot of research the last few weeks. I've been working with, I work in archaeology quite a bit, and we've been working on a few burial sites here in Ontario, specifically burial mounds, just like what we were talking about earlier with the Serpent Mound.
Caleb? Let me ask you to hold, and because we have a break coming in just a few seconds. And, Troy, can you hang on through this break?
Yes.
All right, you hang on. We'll get that answer for you right up after this break, all right? Ladies and gentlemen, we'll return right after this.
And you are listening to the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on earth. Healing medicine for the mind.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Caleb Musgrave. I think our caller has disconnected. Let me see. Yeah, thought so. Okay, but let's go ahead and get that answer for him. What connection to extraterrestrials?
There's a lot of theories. I'm going to turn my speaker down because I can hear my voice again. For some reason, my speaker gets funny on here. There's a lot of different stories coming out and a lot of theories coming out that there's extraterrestrial connections with a lot of the Manitous, as a lack of a better term right now. Sky Woman from the Iroquois stories of how she fell from the sky and helped create Turtle Island, because the Iroquois and the Ojibwe have a very similar creation story, except in our case it's Nanabush floating on the water, and in their stories it's Sky Woman falling from Sky World, which is, in a lot of people's eyes, they look at it as heaven. They live in the spirit world and heaven. But some people are starting to interpret that as she came from a different planet. And the Sky People. I believe it's the Yankton Dakota Elder. I believe his name is Chief Stan... I'm just going to read my note for a second. Chief Standing Elk. He actually believes in the star beings as he interprets them and actually says that he has communicated with them.
Okay.
With a lot of different involvement being happening there and bringing out public talks about it and bringing out a rod of metal with symbols on there that are universal laws. Now, I neither believe nor disbelieve that. To me, it's simply an interpretation, and I, being not him, I cannot tell you what he saw. I cannot tell you what he heard. I don't know what he heard. I will personally say right now, I've never been visited by an extraterrestrial. And as a traditional Anishinaab is what, as we describe ourselves, the Ojibwe is a term that comes from a mix of Cree with European pronunciation. It's a Cree word. Anishinaab or Anishinaabe is what we call ourselves, and it means the original people or the spontaneous people. Our teachings are those people are simply the spirits, the Manitous, and that's what they are. But if you look at it, you can interpret things in different ways. Just like that old story of three blind men finding an elephant, one touches the leg, one touches the tusk, and one touches the tail. They all see different things, but they're all seeing the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
It all has something to do with interpretation. So to me, there's a very good chance that it is extraterrestrial activity, and I never leave that out of the equation. I always put that in there and say, well, it could be an alien. The fact that the Serpent Mound is almost perfectly made to see from the sky, from way up high, not down there on the earth. When you're down on the ground, you can barely see what it is. You have to get up there to look down. And there's not many hills higher than where it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it does lead to the conclusion, did they set that up for the spirits to see, or did they set that up for the aliens to see? That is personal interpretation. I think that is best left at that point. That's really all I got to say on it, other than believe what you
wish. Well, you know, in very broad terms, extraterrestrial doesn't necessarily mean, somebody flying a spaceship. It just means not from this planet. You know, this planet, the word terrestrial comes from the Latin name of the planet, which is Terra. Mm-hmm. So extra Terra means not from here. If the spirit world existed prior to the Earth, which all of the creation stories do say that, then the spirit world is not from here. We are from there. So they are extraterrestrial in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go to the telephone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Yes, you're on the air. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kyle, I'm from Utah.
Okay, and your first name?
I was
Kyle. I know exactly who he is.
I imagine Caleb seems so knowledgeable about the history of Native Americans up there. I've always been curious about. I'm wondering if you have seen
We are trying to hear you, but unfortunately, you've got a very, very bad telephone connection for some reason. Try it again, Mikhail.
Okay. I was just wondering if Caleb's seen or heard of any technologies with the Native Americans there that just seem out of place.
If you're talking specifically regional, rather than just simply the mechanics involved, there are certain tools you find in the Americas that blow people's minds when you think about it. Now, the big one is the Clovis tool, the Paleo-Indian tools. The Paleo-Indians were the ones that were hunting in the mammoth. They were hunting the megafauna of North America when they first arrived. And there's this huge statement that's out there that you can only find Paleo-Indian-style tools like Solutrean blades in Western Europe and the eastern sides of the Americas. Now, the big theory is that they had to have crossed across, and they call it the Solutrean hypothesis. I'm a bit of a believer on it. In fact, I lean towards it more than anything else because I believe that the Americas were more of a migration point. It was just something that people traveled across. You can't tell me that people came from Madagascar to the Australian continent and didn't somehow somebody else come from a different place and arrive in the Americas. But there's also the argument that the Russian government did not have much interest during the communist regime, as some people want to call it, they didn't have much interest in archaeology, and so whenever they came across an archaeological site and it was in the way of where they were trying to build a road, they just pushed it aside and didn't care. So there's very well chance that there's Clovis or Paleo-style points crossing to the Bering Strait, but we have no evidence of it. The other one that comes up is, I'm not sure if you ever heard of a Mequital. I know Mikhail has, because Mikhail and I have actually had long conversations in the past, but Kevin, have you ever heard of a Mequital?
Not that pronunciation of it.
Or some people call it Mockawedle. It's the Aztec sword.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Long club, and it's got these beautiful prismatic lens blades. The technology, the advanced technology that those people made into those obsidian blades, with one strike made a blade that was so sharp it was 10 times sharper than a surgeon's scalpel, and it was made out of stone. That is truly amazing to a lot of people. And they sit there and they think, man, they must have had some advanced technology to figure this stuff out. Well, you got to remember that mankind, if you believe in science, which the majority of humankind does now, if you believe in the concept of evolution, mankind has had stone technology for over 1.5 million years, and we've only had metal for the majority of our world's history, some longer than others. I'll just give an approximate of 10 to 12,000 years, some even less than that. If you want to think that way, and that's including copper and bronze and everything else in there, mm-hmm. That's pretty much the frame time frame that was in. If you compare that 10,000 years to 12,000 years to 1.5 million years, we're going to have advanced stone tech. You're going to find that wherever you look in the world. And they find it. Danish daggers from Denmark that are amazing pieces of flint work. And, of course, the Mequital or the Mockawedle sword, the Aztec sword made out of obsidian. It comes down to ingenuity and people playing with it. So, to me, there's not too much shock and awe about these tools so much as an awe and wonder of how it was made. Not the idea of how did they get the idea of it, because that came after over a million years of playing with the stuff. If you sit there and play with Play-Doh day in and day out, after a while, you figure how to do everything you can do with Play-Doh. It takes a while, but you learn it all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much that.
Along those lines, though, I agree with what you're saying, but along those lines, people need to know that when the Europeans first encountered the Ojibwe, they were also in shock and awe because the Ojibwe had copper-tipped arrows.
Yep.
So
just pulled up. I was at the Royal mm-hmm. Ontario Museum just last week analyzing some artifacts from a burial mound from nearby, and they had beautiful needles made out of copper. They looked like modern-day sewing needles. There was mm-hmm. no discerning difference except that one was green from the copper oxidizing, and the one that's in my sewing kit is gray-brown-silver color.
Yeah, there you go.
It's amazing, the technology, the fact that without glass and without plastic and without most metals except for copper, we were in a very advanced culture here, and people didn't realize that until they got here. The language, the technology, the science behind it, it's amazing. It truly is. It's a wonder of mankind, but if you look at human history, you find it. It's just always there, and no matter where you look. Some of them are more simple. Australian Aborigines just breaking a rock and using that to cut down a tree. That doesn't really impress a lot of people, but you think about all the work put in there. They know exactly where to hit that tree to break it.
Mm-hmm.
It really is wonderful.
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me about this thing with the copper-tipped arrows is what that tells you is that the Ojibwe had developed metallurgy.
Yeah. There's even evidence that they're still finding that the Zuni and the, not the Apache, my mistake, the Zuni and the Hopi, and I believe even Navajo, actually were starting to get very close to smelting their own silver. If they weren't already, when the Europeans arrived, they were very good at it. If you look at Navajo silver, a lot of that is smelted by themselves or shaped that by themselves. But you can find copper tools down in the southwest on occasion, most of the copper being traded from up in my region in Canada in the Great Lakes area, being shipped down and through trade networks. But even mm-hmm. silver work was being found in some sites.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the verge of what the Greek were on and the Mesopotamians and pretty much all of modern civilization in Europe. When Columbus arrived and Jacques Cartier and can't remember his first name, but Champlain, when they arrived and got into these certain areas, they were seeing exactly what happened to their ancestors 8,000 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, well, obviously you're behind on times. Yeah, but when you come into the continent so much later in history, that happens. You don't have time to sit there and play with until agriculture arrives only about 5,000, 8,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was only in this last period that we started playing with that stuff, but it's amazing.
Well, and you mentioned agriculture. That is a technology in itself. When we say technology, a lot of times people are thinking of machinery.
Yeah,
but
it's technology is everything.
Well, and the Ojibwe, as they moved from the east to the west and began to spread out, they came to an area where there was wild rice.
The food grows in water, the third fire of our prophecies.
Yeah, and they learned to domesticate it.
Yep, there's a, I believe it was a report from an anthropologist and an ethnobotanist from back in the 80s. They actually came to the conclusion that 90% of all foods that we eat in the world, their origins came from the Americas, whether it was squash, beans, corn, the three sisters of the Iroquois people, sweet potato, the common domestic sweet potato, originates in South America. Although there were other varieties in the world, that's the one that we domesticated the most. All the way to regular potatoes. Everybody thinks potatoes, they think of English cuisine and Irish cuisine. The potato had a very humble origin here in North America and South America. Most food, they even had down in the Incan territories, they actually had vicuna and llama being raised for wool and being raised for, on occasion, meat and everything else. Mm-hmm. So we were on agriculture, very advanced agriculture here in the Americas. We didn't rely on a lot of the grains that everybody had back in Mesopotamia, grinding up the wheats and the barleys and the oats. But we had very advanced foodstuffs that lasted all through the year, such as the corn and such as sweet potato and even carrots.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's important out of this discussion, at least from my point of view, everybody else will have their own point of view of what you think is important out of this. What's important out of this is that, you know, what you're hearing here tonight, folks, is about an ancient people who still exist, who still have ancient records of their ancient past. It's not like down in as you called it, Inca land. It's not like in the Mayan lands. All the writings, most of the writings got destroyed by the conquistadors. It's not like that place, and it's a different culture. But what you're hearing is a people who, unlike the Mayan, unlike the Inca, unlike the Aztec, have survived in great numbers and must know something about how you survive. Okay? That's important, to listen to people who have successfully navigated these waters before. All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Caleb Lister. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Caleb Musgrave. He is Ojibwe, and he lives in Canada, and we're talking about the influence that the Ojibwe culture actually still has over all of North America, and I guess probably some in South America, but over all of North America, this culture has influence, and we have remnants of past influence wrapped up in the fabric of our everyday lives. And as I said before we went away for break, you know, this is a group of people, the Ojibwe, who have survived French colonization. They have survived, well, they've survived before that. They survived the Ice Age. Then they survived French colonization. They survived British colonization. They survived Canadian laws that said it was illegal for them to do what they do and be what they are. They've survived the same sort of stuff in the what is today the United States of America, because the United States of America, when it was newly formed, started off not keeping treaties. mm-hmm. and has continued to do that. There are many, many treaties that they have with these First Nations, with these Native Nations, that they still don't keep. But they've survived this. And I think it's important for all of the rest of us to listen to people who have survived all of this and are still thriving, because rough days are coming. I am not saying that December 21st, 2012 is the Earthbuster, but I don't care who you are, or tough times are coming at some point in your life, and this body of knowledge is important for survival. All right, let's go to the telephone, and caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. Turn your radio down and talk to us on the phone. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello. Bonjour. Wawatasi, Indigenous cause. It's Brian.
Brian. Anin.
Anin.
This is one of my fellow brothers of the nation.
Oh, okay, Brian. What's on your mind?
I have a bit of a... I'm assuming I still have you on the line there.
Yep.
Okay. I've been listening to a little bit about the survival, how some people have still managed to survive all of this time. Mm-hmm. And we're focusing on the Anishinaabe.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to come to an understanding that pretty well all people on the planet have had to survive some form of catastrophe, or in a natural sense. My question goes to the other side. We've talked about weaponry, and there's a subtlety about weaponry and a dark side to the weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that we use it, the best technology we've ever had historically, right up to this very day, we've used on ourselves to protect ourselves from each other. I mean, we still need police forces, we still need militaries, all to protect ourselves from each other. And so in the sense of survival, my question comes down to, where is it in your scenario of survival that you may have to protect yourself from other people, and how would you go about doing that?
Whew. That's a toughie when it comes down to it. If we're going to talk about the earthquake scenario that we were talking about earlier, there is that big problem. If anybody remembers Katrina, what was one of the biggest problems that happened right after Katrina was the looting. And there was violence left, right, and center in Katrina. Crime happens, and it increases whenever there's chaos, because people think, hey, there's no cops here. What's stopping me from doing it? The biggest concern in Canada is castle law does not exist here. You have to understand the laws, because even though you're defending yourself from the lawbreakers, in some states and in many provinces here in Canada, just because you're defending yourself from the lawbreakers does not mean that you are above the law. You do not have that ability, even in a chaotic situation. In Canada, the majority rule of it is, if you have a way of escape, escape. And that's pretty much the law. I'm not going to say that I agree with that, because I don't. I believe that... If you look at me, I'm a husky guy. I'm not going to be able to fit through most of the windows in my house to get away from the bad guy if he breaks in. So my belief is I'm going to make sure my family and my loved ones are protected, and that's just simply how it is. If the police decide to tell me that I'm a criminal for that, I'm not going to feel bad going to prison for protecting my loved ones. If my wife or my kids are in danger, if I go to jail for protecting them, then I think that's a worthy reason to go to... I think that's a worthy reason to still break that law. That's your personal decision you have to make. When it comes down to it, some people like to stock up on ammunition. Some people like to stock up on different varieties of weapons. If you watch that Doomsday Prepper, some guys just like to train how to use a tomahawk and throw and fight with it. I'm not going to necessarily agree with that, because guy has a hunting rifle and he's 100 yards away from me. Good luck throwing that tomahawk before he pulls a trigger. But it comes down to your scenario and what you can legally achieve. Do you think in your scenario that lethal force is needed? If that is the case and you can prove that case to the law, then, and you feel that you are willing to do so, even if it does not prove, even if you cannot prove it to the law that you feel the need and are threatened, and your life or your loved ones' lives are at risk, and you believe lethal force is needed, then you need to prepare for that scenario. Whether that means you need to take some, I'm not going to say martial arts, because in my opinion, martial arts and the majority of them don't work in a lot of the situations. If the guy's 5 feet away from me and has a pistol pointed at my head, chances are I'm going to get shot before I can do a big wacha move or anything like that, a ki. I'm going to get shot.
Well, let me say this, having spent my life as a cop and having worked in very dangerous territories, these days I don't have a gun, okay? Mm-hmm. I am certified by the NRA as a firearms instructor, okay? And I spent years carrying a gun, and people, when I tell them I don't have a gun, they think, well, that means I'm opposed to guns. I'm not opposed to guns. I like guns. You know, if you're going hunting, a gun's a great thing. If you're being shot at, and, you know, well, it's nice to have a gun. But here's the deal. If you're being shot at, you have to understand that if you have a clear shot at him, he's got a clear shot at you. Mm-hmm. Your number one thing you have to do to stay alive, if the first shot misses, is haul booty to cover. Get under cover quick. Get behind cover quick. If he can't see you, his gun can't either. Mm-hmm. Okay? A bullet flies line of sight. All right? So you get behind cover. Now, what happens if you're behind cover and he walks up on you? Well, if he walks up on you, he's, you know, you need to keep moving. But if he walks up on you, he's now touchable. And you need to know how to turn off the light switches by touching. Okay? Some people say, well, they feel safer with a gun. Okay. Well, if you do, I understand that. But the point is, if I can touch you, it's over. Mm-hmm. If I can't touch you, I'm going to be behind cover, because if I can see you, you can see me. And if you can see me, your gun can see me. So I'll be behind cover. This is not theory. This is something I've actually lived. Okay? You get behind cover if there are bullets whizzing by. So that they have to hit that cover before they can get to you. Hey, it's been great. Thanks for being with us. I want you to stay on the line with me, and we'll chat after I bring this to a close. I wasn't watching the clock. It took over. We're at the end. Ladies and gentlemen, my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.